Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, Ken Morris, co-author of a new book on Sarah Palin. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Julia Ott, also the author of a new book, this one on how Wall Street promoted a bogus notion of investor democracy starting about 100 years ago, a campaign that continues to pay political dividends today. Before that, some words on the news, but not that many, since there's not much new in it. The economy still stinks, and is likely to continue to do so for some time. At least Europeans are fighting against the austerity demanded by the EU, Frankfurt, and the IMF. There have been some excellent riots in Athens, and the other day, 500 Spaniards gathered to block a house foreclosure. Apparently, we don't do things like that. Speaking of austerity, the Wall Street Journal reported on Friday that the AARP, nominally an interest group fighting on behalf of older Americans, has decided to stop resisting calls for cuts to Social Security benefits, reversing its long opposition to such a cruel move. The group's policy chief, John Rother, said, "The ship was sailing. I wanted to be at the wheel when that happens." But of course, he's not going to be at the wheel. His change of heart is going to make it a lot easier for bad people to take that wheel. Rother was apparently inspired to make the change by the news that Obama is planning to tackle Social Security sometime in his first, and possibly only, presidential term. "I've long thought that it's going to take a Democrat to cut Social Security, and along with it Medicare, since Republicans would attract too much opposition. But if you've got a Democrat pushing the program, a lot of its natural opposition will be disarmed." Social Security is not a serious problem. Talk of its imminent bankruptcy is way overblown and based on extremely gloomy economic and demographic assumptions. But even if, and that's a big if, but even if those were to come to pass, the numbers are actually quite small by the standards of the federal budget. For example, if you just remove the cap on the Social Security tax, wage and salary income above $106,800 is now exempt from the tax, as is investment income. Remove that cap and Social Security would be solvent as far as the eye could see, even given the bearish underlying assumptions. So this really is a non-problem. AARP has essentially become an insurance company. It opposed single-payer because it sells health insurance, though they'll give you a lot of nonsensical policy justifications for their self-interested stance. I wouldn't be surprised at all if it's now looking to expand as the retirement annuity business. But if Social Security cuts go through, cat food might be a more promising line of business. Let's take a musical break and we'll be back to talk about Sarah Palin.
Soviet nerve gas attack. In 6 seconds, they'll be pushing on your back. Get a drop on your skin, and convulsions will set in. Soviet nerve gas attack. Soviet nerve gas is strange. In a missile with a 1,000-mile range, it spreads out a mile to contaminate a while. Soviet nerve gas is strange. Soviet nerve gas is strong. Snort it up, and you won't be snorting long. An insecticide for men, it's genocide again. Soviet nerve gas is strong.
That was an obscure gem from 1980, a band called Zex, spelled X-E-X, doing the song Soviet Nerve Gas Attack. Zex was a group formed in the late 1970s in a working-class suburb in central New Jersey. Almost anything involving New Jersey is at least a little funny. I can say that because I grew up in the Garden State. But it does seem funny to think of a group of alienated New Jersey kids forming an electro band way ahead of their time and singing songs about nerve gas. Which is a bit of a setup for this next segment about a former governor who claimed foreign policy experience because you can see Russia from Alaska. I feel a little funny about this, I must say. I've avoided all the cheap shots one can fire at Sarah Palin because it's just too easy. Democrats love that sort of thing because it's a distraction from just how awful they are. But on the other hand, a country that can elevate Sarah Palin to the position of a major political celebrity is pretty messed up. So I shouldn't let my reticence about cheap shots keep me from looking at this. So here we go. My first guest is Ken Morris, co-author of Blind Allegiance to Sarah Palin, The author whose name appears in the big type in the cover is Frank Bailey, a regular guy from Kodiak, Alaska, who became enchanted with Palin during her initial campaign for governor. He worked with her for years and then became extremely disillusioned, to the point of writing a tell-all book. His collaborators are Ken Morris, a former investment banker, from whom we'll hear in just a moment, and Gene Devon, keeper of the blog The Mudflats, which covers Alaska politics. When their manuscript was nearly complete, the journalist Joe McGinnis, who'd moved to Wasilla to write a book about Palin, leaked it on the Internet. That move destroyed a lot of the manuscript's news and economic value, so publishers got cold feet. Luckily for the author, Simon & Schuster's religious imprint, Howard Books, picked it up. Now here's Ken Morris. The big name on the cover is Frank Bailey. Who is Frank Bailey?
Frank Bailey his parents moved to Alaska from Central California when he was 2 years old, and he lived on little Kodiak, big Kodiak Island, little in population, and grew up very poor and struggled to literally survive when he was young. And he became, of all things, a baggage handler at a small airline in Alaska, worked his way up to kind of low to middle management of this very tiny Alaskan regional airline. And he had, like most Alaskans, an interest in sort of the political history of the state, which was known for its massive political corruption, really kind of the theft of the state's natural resource, oil, by the oil companies who paid off politicians. And when Sarah Palin, who had been, of course, mayor of Wasilla, ran for lieutenant governor, she lost, in fact, a couple of years earlier, it shone kind of a political light on her, and she came to Frank's attention as well as other conservatives. And Frank, to this day, sort of says, I am a Fox News conservative. His collaboration with me and Jeannie Devon have not changed his politics, though they have changed his enlightenment, I'd like to say. So anyway, he heard that she might be running. He looked her up in the White Pages, phoned her, said, I want to volunteer if and when you run. When she announced she was going to run, he went to her first fundraiser, introduced himself, and a week later he was in the campaign office painting walls and was the only non-family member to begin that first day. And he ended up virtually running her campaign, kind of a jack-of-all-trades, but was her right-hand man in running the campaign, organizing volunteers, helping to raise money. And then when she was elected governor, he then served in her cabinet through her resignation about 2 years out later.
She had to face a primary. And how did she enter this primary? As an underdog or as a breath of fresh air? What was her positioning in this three-way primary?
Certainly she was perceived of as a breath of fresh air. And in Alaska, the whole state has a population less than the population of Tucson, Arizona. There are fewer than 700,000 people in the state. And about 57%, I think, is the number of the voting citizens are not even registered in either party. It's a very independent-minded sort of electorate. So she came in, and there was no prejudice against somebody being mayor of Wasilla, because Wasilla, with only 6,000 people, a few years later, was, I think, the fourth or fifth largest city in the entire state. And so she had a reputation as no-nonsense, and she was very vocal with respect to the two things that were most important, which was how to return oil revenues to the people, and her anti-corruption rhetoric. Where she was the underdog was in money. The big money went to her opponents in the primaries. What sold papers was having Sarah Palin's face on newspapers, and what caused people to tune in to shows was having her on shows. And so what money couldn't buy is all of that free publicity. And the people embraced that message, and she was variously described as a Cinderella story, but she had a lot of support virtually by just announcing, because she was the right time, right place, and the citizens were sick and tired of the old boys network in Alaska. So she stepped in right at exactly the right time, and the momentum from the first day was dramatic, and her poll numbers, almost from the day she announced, eclipsed her opponents.
To me, and I'm sure to many people listening, she comes off as a dope and a lunatic. And what insulated her from that perception in Alaska? Is it? Are we missing something, or is it just Alaska's a different place?
Well, it's not just Alaska. Don't forget that when she was on the Republican ticket, she of the Republican Party, and afterwards was the prohibitive favorite amongst the GOP electorate. And she had well over 50% approval rating overall in the entire country, and this is while her approval ratings in Alaska were plummeting. So to call her a dope is, I think, a very dangerous thing. She has, it's a strange mix of appeal, simple appeal. It's, I think, wearing thin a bit now, but the way that our electorate changes its mind, I wouldn't bet against it changing again. I mean, I tell people, don't forget Richard Nixon survived his Checker speech and eventually became president of the United States. And she's not entirely a dope. And the thing that gave that impression was the Katie Couric interview where she couldn't name anything she read. And that, we explain in the book, was a moment of her trying to find an answer that made her look, to made her intellect look broader than it was. And by that I mean she did read, and she does read, and she reads somewhat vociferously. But what she reads are, to the extent they're not blogs that are critical of her, which she spends an inordinate amount of time reading and responding to. She reads, she digested mainly Alaska, state of Alaska type information, whether it was the Alaska, the Anchorage Daily News, or the Alaska Economic Review. She received a packet summarizing articles and events throughout the state every morning. It was as many as 50 or 60 pages that she would read before 8 in the morning. So that really wasn't fair. But what we believe and what Frank believed was that she was trying to find an answer that made her look like she had this intellectual intellect. And she didn't know the name of the Times of London. She didn't want to say the New York Times because she hated the New York Times. So she fumbled and became that deer in the headlight moment and made her look just stupid. And we have a scene in the book where Frank is watching the TV, watching this interview, and he's slapping his head going, why can't you just tell the truth? It's not a big deal that the governor of Alaska spends most of her time reading things about Alaska and not about Cuba or about the Soviet Union or about Japan. That will make sense to people. And, you know, kind of his way of thinking, he said, you don't have to tell them that you spend just as much time on negative blogs or on People magazine. And so that came across poorly, but it doesn't reflect the truth. So that's an example of she's not nearly as shallow intellectually as people think.
Back to the early days as governor of Alaska, it became quickly apparent to Frank Bailey, although I think he resisted the perception at first, that this was a very vindictive person and petty and subject to rages and eager to smoke out anybody who says anything that she doesn't like. Tell us about her personality. What drives these rages that she seems to be capable of?
Well, you know, you describe it perfectly. The way that we sort of came to describe it and the way that I would write on Frank's behalf as we discussed trying to characterize her personality was that, and this is a bit of an oxymoron, she's an Old Testament Christian. And, of course, Christianity began with the birth of Christ in the New Testament, so that's why it's an oxymoron. But she's a revisionist at that. She took the Old Testament lesson of an eye for an eye, and she turned it into two eyes for an eye. And eventually it became any minor slight, and she would go into a rage, and nothing less than the destruction of that person's personality. Even if it was a slight or something that she felt cast her in a bad light, that was unintentional. And she couldn't control those rages. And you know, psychology would say there's a complex combination of things, paranoia, and certainly she exhibits massive amounts of paranoia. She had her office swept for bugs. She was always of the belief that people were bugging her, reading her emails to sabotage her. She believed that there were conspiracies going on between people who didn't even like each other but were coming together to get her. She had her home swept for bugs. It went on and on and on, and she has no ability to look at the world any further than how it impacts her. So, you know, that's narcissism, I guess, would be another way of looking at it. So, because really this is Frank's story, Frank Bailey's story. There's no way that we had a sense that we should go back and try to explain why she's the way she is. We simply explain what it was like to be with her for 4 years in the middle of this. And it's, you know, it's really Frank's story with her. And because they intersected on a daily basis up to 80 hours a week for 4 years, clearly, you know, that's where sort of the engine of the story goes. But it has, you know, it starts with hope, it ends with hope, and in the middle is a big, giant mess of Sarah Palin.
I'm speaking with Ken Morris, co-author of Blind Allegiance, just out from Howard Books. One of the mysteries to a lot of people who followed the Palin vice presidential campaign was the whole Troopergate thing. And I finally began to understand it reading this book, but could you lay it out for the listeners? What was the whole Troopergate fiasco of that?
Yeah, Troopergate, if the book has what you know you think of as a heart, the heart of the book is Troopergate, because Frank you know, will be forever linked with that saga. Trooper Mike Wooten was Sarah's ex-brother-in-law. He was married to Molly McCann, Sarah's sister. And they went through a very bitter divorce and child custody battle. Back, as far back as 2005, when this began to, the nastiness began to broil, before Frank even knew Sarah Palin, Sarah and Todd Palin, along with close family members, began what was became a four-year vendetta against this trooper, doing everything at their disposal to destroy him. And the hatred became compulsive, especially for Todd Palin. And when Frank came onto the scene, he began to see kind of the periphery of this trooper, Mike Wooten saga, but never knew about how far-reaching the vendetta had extended. He also was unaware of the fact that the trooper organization itself had investigated, had dealt with whatever complaints were outstanding. He was not aware that the Palins went to try to destroy this man's personal life, getting removed as a volunteer coach of the high school team, planning stories about him. They eventually became paranoid that this guy was spreading rumors about Sarah to try to defeat her when she was running for governor. And it went on and on and on. And Todd one day came to Frank, and he solicited Frank to get involved. And Frank believed in his heart of hearts that Trooper Wooten was dangerous to the Palins, that this was a guy who would pull his gun one day and fire at the governor. And he had this image that he'd have to lay down his life one day. And that's the story that they sort of fed him. And he believed it. And so he became involved in trying to get this trooper removed with a very, very small insight into what was really going on, as did on behalf of the Palins, the people in the administration, staff, et cetera, made well over 20 calls to various government officials trying to get this person removed. The difference was that Frank made a call that was recorded, and it came out 6 months later while Sarah was denying when she fired Walt Monaghan, who was Wooten's boss and a cabinet member, and she essentially removed him from office because he would not fire Wooten. In fact, could not, but he would not fire Trooper Wooten. And so that tape came out when all of a sudden people were saying, well, Sarah, you abused your office to fire someone for personal reasons. And she denied that she had any idea of what was going on. And, you know, the book paints a very clear picture that she was being serially untruthful. Diplomatic way to say she was lying. And Todd did the same thing. And so poor Frank got in the middle of this, and he became the Troopergate guy and was raked over the coals. Sarah laid all the blame on him. And when the details finally came out much later in our document, in our book, Frank, in fact, when we did the book, became shocked at all the information we had uncovered about this saga and the Sarah and the Palins. I mean, just horrible, horrible behavior for years and years and years. So, you know, that's a longer explanation than you probably wanted, but that's essentially what went on.
And for all her family values talk, the Palin family is not exactly Norman Rockwell material, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, you know, we actually, once the manuscript got leaked, we have perhaps a dozen interviews with people who came forward afterwards that we almost used in the book but decided not to because it wasn't part of Frank's story that Jeannie and I may at some point use. But the story is even darker than we paint in the book, and what we paint in the book is clearly of a dysfunctional family. Todd, to his credit, is a very loving father, and he became father and mother when he was there. You know, he worked on the North Slope, you know, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off type of deal. Sarah was completely uninvolved. If her children were doing poorly in school, it was the coach's fault or it was the school administrator's fault. There was never a discussion about taking time off to help with homework. It was always the same thing she did. She was the victim, and she had people to blame. Frank, you know, is very, you know, to this day is very sad for the kids and feels, I mean, in his heart of hearts, he just feels pulled and depressed about, you know, how these kids were neglected. And when Sarah accepted the vice presidency, Bristol Palin's pregnancy had not yet been announced. And the first thing that went through, and Frank was aware she was pregnant, and the first thing that went through Frank's mind was, Sarah, how could you do this? Your daughter is now going to become the most famous unwed mother in modern history. And, you know, Bristol was a very sweet, emotional girl. And Frank, his biggest shock was, how could you do this to your daughter just so that you can have this run for the vice presidency? And he never understood that, doesn't understand that decision to this day.
I think it's a mystery to a lot of people outside Alaska. But she goes back to Alaska after the defeat and very soon afterwards resigns as governor. What was that all about?
Well, you know, the hardest part of doing the research on this book, and just to give you a little background, we had emails that were in the Yahoo accounts. These were to or from Frank, and these were things in the non-governmental email accounts, just so it's clear. We have been accused of accessing Sarah's personal, I mean, which is rubbish. We did not. But Frank had in these accounts sort of his historical record of what went on in these Yahoo accounts, 60,000 emails. And Jeannie and I spent 6 months going through those. And I happened to draw the straw where I was opening and reading Frank's emails from 2009 when she returned. And it was the most depressing part of this whole process was looking at that period of time. And the reason is that one vendetta after another began to stack up. And Sarah spent, and when I say no time on government, I am not exaggerating. All she did was further her national spotlight and attack enemies. And the list of people that she was going after at any one time, juggling, had to have reached a dozen at a time. And it was every time I would go to the next email, there'd be a new person that she was complaining about, whining about, whether it was David Letterman. She hated Newt Gingrich and went after him. Her neighbor next door in Juneau, she tried to ruin this man for complaining about bus congestion. She then came to Carrie Prejean's aide, the Miss America contestant, who had supported only heterosexual marriage, and she went on the national spotlight to support that. And she went after bloggers one at a time, and it just never ended. And it was very hard to watch. And in the meantime, she had her staff helping her put together this book that she had signed to quote-unquote write. And so her staff was involved in that. She would just make suggestions about what should be included in the book. That was her contribution to the whole material. And so she was very much preoccupied. She had a multi-million-dollar advance going on. And she consistently, and we have again in the book, several instances where she simply said, I hate this damn job. And, you know, this is a kangaroo court joke of a job. And please hope, you know, when she was running for vice president, she wrote Frank and said, please pray that I win so I don't have to go back to that place. She hated her job. She hated the discipline of having to govern and wanted out. And she was just looking for an excuse. She really didn't find one. So one day she got up. She hadn't even told Todd she was going to resign. He was in Dillingham on getting ready to do a commercial fishing run. And she phoned him while he was on the boat. He had to quickly get off the boat, fly back to be next to her the next day. And then she gave this rambling speech that made no sense to anybody, and about being a lame duck. And without an excuse, she made one up that made no sense. And that was as much as we can tell you about it. It was for money and because she just hated her job and wanted to be on the national spotlight. There's no other reason that exists.
And now here she is on her bus tour. She has some of the worst numbers in the history of polling. And just the other day she botched the Paul Revere story. Yet she will not go away. I mean, is she somebody we should worry about, or is she so preposterous that she's not going to go anywhere electorally?
Well, I kind of have two ways to approach that. Number one is that the book is bigger than Sarah Palin. It really is how we fail, all of us, voters and media and our other politicians. And my sense is, if not Sarah, then someone else. I mean, Donald Trump was the GOP front runner there for, if it was for a nanosecond, it just proves the point. But with respect to Sarah Palin, her base is still so committed, and I know because we're being attacked. Someone hacked my Facebook and sent out, you know, porn videos. We're being attacked everywhere. Nothing in the book's being attacked. There's not been one word to refute any or refutiate, as Sarah would say, anything in the book. It's all everything around the book. Frank Bailey's a bad guy, this and that. You know, Ken Morris, you know, there was a story out there that I was an advisor to Barack Obama, and how could I have participated in this book fairly? Well, you know, President Obama, if you're listening, I'd be happy to become an advisor, but I am not certainly one now. So she has this rabid base that won't go away. The other side of that coin is that we are in an era now after the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United where someone with a rabid base and even with very low approval ratings can still win national office because of swift boat type of negative ads that now are unregulated. The trick really is to make your opponent even less favorable. And the attack ads will go. And in the meantime, as you know, there's this film that's done by an ex-Goldman Sachs banker, which is kind of funny because I'm an ex-Morgan Stanley banker, so it's Morgan Stanley versus Goldman Sachs. But with this ex-Goldman Sachs that is, quote-unquote, so supposedly based on her book, that will go out and people will watch that and it will change minds. People then will come away with all that warm, fuzzy feeling and say, wow, I misjudged her. She really is sweet. So we're in a different world now. I would not count her out as something someday. As I say, Nixon survived Checkers. But if it isn't her, you know, the message of the book really is, hey, we're doing a bad job. It'll be someone else. I come away afraid no matter what happens.
It's a measure of where we are that one looks back to Nixon now as a kind of substantial figure. That was Ken Morris, co-author along with Frank Bailey and Gene Devon of Blind Allegiance to Sarah Palin, just out from Howard Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Julia Ott.
Daddy was returning in his funeral urn. Cracks in the crumble wall now. My dad is stoned. Thunder. Papa told me she misses you. Come back to Moscow. It's a thing to do.
More Zex, X-E-X, that's spelled. The song Svetlana, about Stalin's daughter. Be a good Bolshevik, I'm not a no good Nick. My next guest is Julia Ott, author of When Wall Street Meant Main Street, The Quest for Investors' Democracy, just out from Harvard University Press. Julia Ott teaches at the New School in New York. Although it's hard to believe now, a century ago, there were mass political movements, socialists, labor radicals, populists, that troubled Wall Street's sleep. Wall Street's response was a PR scheme, and a very successful one it was. We'll hear all about this from Julia Ott. Welcome, Julia. Let's go back to the turn of the last century and the emergence in a very short period of time, just less than 10 years, really, of, in many ways, the modern large corporation and modern securities markets. Now, this transformation had an important effect on the psychology of American democracy, right? We had been, a proprietary democracy, valuing the small holder, and then suddenly the large corporation came in. What was the cultural reaction to this massive and rather rapid transformation?
Well, it's true, as you say, that this is sort of a central fact and a central, social question of the era. What to do, how to make American democratic government and American democratic values and principles consistent with the large industrial corporation, or I should say make the large industrial corporation consistent with American political traditions and political values. And people in the era referred to this question as the trust problem. And there's really a wide-ranging conversation all across the political spectrum, from socialists who would like to see these things nationalized to, labor movement that would like to see, workers organized, to the folks that I study who begin to imagine that perhaps the financial securities markets, which had been an instrument for forming these massive trusts, could actually be also a tool for reforming them. First of all, through legislation that would bring more scrutiny to bear on the process by which large industrial corporations formed and bring more scrutiny into their practices. But then secondarily, perhaps if we reformers envision that perhaps if we clean up those processes through the reform of financial reporting, through the reform of the way in which corporations issued their securities, through the way in which financial securities traded on exchanges, if we clean this all up, if we reform all this and sort of bring regulation to bear, regulatory oversight to bear on the securities markets, then maybe it would be safe for every American to actually invest in these corporations. And that would be the best means, some of these reformers envisioned, for making large industrial corporations consistent with American political values. Spread the ownership, so that everyone could feel that they had a stake in the, dramatic economic changes that were being experienced in the United States at that time.
Now, if we step back into the 19th century, Wall Street was not really a popular place with most of the American public, was it?
No, not at all. I mean, you can go all the way back to the Revolution, and you can, look at in post-Revolution period and look at a guy like Alexander Hamilton, who, even had to spend a lot of time convincing, Congress that a large federal debt, involving lots of outstanding federal securities, state securities, federal bonds, was a good thing. And, Hamilton has to spend a lot of time defending investors as somebody who could, or a group of people who could, be brought along as supporters in the democratic experiment. But generally speaking, the securities markets are a very, in the United States, they're a very marginal phenomenon. And perceived as disreputable. Speculators are perceived as manipulators of value who, buy and sell securities and, create bubbles and corner the market in securities to the detriment of the public. And they're also perceived as sort of a parasitic class who isn't really doing any real work. So Americans really, throughout the 19th century, have the notion that, the virtuous citizen, the kind of American who is the most desired type of political actor is a person who owns tangible assets.
That would be a farmer or artisan.
A farmer, an artisan, even like a an independent shopkeeper or something like that. But, the people who make a living from the fluctuations of security prices are not seen as contributing much value to the economy or to society.
And the securities that were traded in those days, the common stock was very rare.
American enterprise by and large really doesn't use the securities markets to raise any kind of funds to build productive enterprises. The entities that do, like the railroads, for example, the bulk of those securities are also actually traded abroad. Part of the marginality or suspicion that Americans hold for investors is that there's just not a very big investing class investing in financial securities in the United States. United States. So there's sort of no reason to believe that those people's interests, you know, people who are investors or are traders in securities, that their economic interests are something that the political system should really protect or look out for in any way, shape, or form.
And now returning to the turn of the century, I think a lot of people don't appreciate this, but the emergence of this large corporation came with it, or was financed or lubricated by also the creation of large amounts of securities. These two things emerged together, very large securities markets and the very large corporation. They're like two sides of the same coin, so to speak, right?
Right, correct. But the thing that's interesting here is that, you know, people like, you know, say, for example, Andrew Carnegie, you know, or Rockefeller putting together Standard Oil, Carnegie putting together U.S. Steel, they use the securities markets to buy up existing firms and to combine them into a new kind of, in the parlance of the day, monopolistic type of corporation like U.S. Steel. But they're not turning to the securities markets to sort of build new plants, buy productive equipment, you know, that kind of stuff. And so,
which is still more or less the case.
Which is still more or less the case today. So, I mean, one of the things the book talks about and what I was really interested in is, you know, how do Americans get the idea that when you invest in a stock, you're giving money to a corporation to sort of build enterprise? Because you're not doing that at all. You're just buying a security from another investor. Your money goes to another investor. And the corporation sees none of that money. And so a large question that I had when I started the project was to try to understand, you know, how these sorts of erroneous assumptions, you know, sometimes that happens in an IPO situation, but even like in an IPO situation, a lot of times you're just buying out existing investors who, you know, want to cash out on the investment that they made privately in a prior period. So I was very interested in where those ideas came from.
So tell us, where did this idea begin to emerge from?
Well, so that idea, the idea that the stock market funds entrepreneurial enterprises directly, I trace it really to the public relations efforts of the New York Stock Exchange, who New York Stock Exchange finds itself, as I say in the book, caught in the crosshairs of progressive reform when Woodrow Wilson, particularly when Woodrow Wilson is elected to office. And they feel like they're going to have to articulate a productive identity and explanation and rationale for themselves if they're going to avoid this kind of regulatory oversight. So that's one of the arguments that they make. And, you know, sort of basically in the footnotes they'll say, well, you know, actually what you do when you invest is you give money to another investor, but like if that market didn't exist, that original investor, you know, if there wasn't a market where someplace in the future the entrepreneur couldn't cash out, the entrepreneur would never make the investment in the first place, the private investment in the first place. And that, you could say, strictly speaking, is more accurate in terms of the role that the financial securities play, what their relationship is to the real economy. But their sound bites, that are kind of always what they say first and repeat the loudest, is simply that the stock exchange funds productive enterprise. You know, they encourage people to have that sort of assumption.
They're still saying that, because I went on a floor tour with some BBC guys who were doing a documentary on the stock exchange about 10 years ago, and I told them before, I was supposed to be their truth squad, then, I said, but before we went on the tour, I said, ask him what this is all about. Like, so because I knew the press officer was going to recite precisely that line. You know,
right.
Funding enterprise. It was a perfect setup for me to be the truth squad.
Right.
But you know, that this is the press office has been saying this for close to a century now.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And actually, one of the reasons why that question became so interesting to me was, first of all, the .com bubble. When I, you know, started with the topic, you know, about in graduate school many, many years ago. But also when I was in college, I had a internship at a money manager, an investment manager, and I knew nothing about, you know, financial securities markets and nothing about investment. And I bought Peter Lynch's Learn to Earn, you know, thinking, you know, maybe I'll know something when I show up for work tomorrow. I won't sound like a complete ignoramus. And one of the first things Peter Lynch explains in Learn to Earn is, you know, when you make an investment, you're just buying out another investor. You're not actually giving money to the corporation. And I was so disappointed. I really thought, I mean, I wasn't under the illusion that my summer internship was like, you know, a nonprofit internship, but I had some sort of sense that, like, you know, if you're an investment manager, you're putting people's, you know, hard-earned savings to work to build America. And, you know, in fact, that's not the case. But it got me very interested in where that idea comes from, because it is an idea, an assumption that isn't strictly true, but I think people still walk around.
And as Rockefeller, you point out in the book, Rockefeller Sr. Wanted to make sure that Standard Oil financed itself internally.
Right, and plenty of corporations, you know, did and still do today. So Standard Oil is, you know, the classic example of, they finally go public public in like 1920. But Rockefeller's very, very concerned that they finance out of earnings because he doesn't want to hear from shareholders, you know, some massive shareholders, you know, what their opinions are. The other classic example is Henry Ford, who doesn't go public until, I think, the 50s.
Yes.
And he's really quite in contrast to the whole, I mean, you know, explicitly, his Dearborn Independence is always taking
shots. And he also
was
worried about the Jews, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, to him, the stock market is the embodiment of not only like a Jewish conspiracy, but also, you know, still an older notion of this is a parasitic thing that actually doesn't contribute to productive enterprise. And I, Henry Ford, retain my earnings and I pay high wages and I put my money back into my business. And, you know, the securities markets play no role in my company. So the New York Stock Exchange and Henry Ford at that literal historical moment, you know, they're sort of great antagonists in terms of their model of what the relationship between the real economy and the securities markets is and should be.
I'm speaking with Julia Ott, author of When Wall Street Met Main Street, The Quest for Investors' Democracy, just out from Harvard University Press. Okay, so we're talking about the teens and the Wilson years. Now, this was something with a history of a lot of socialist, populist pressure. And critique of the emergence of the large corporation. But it took, what, a couple of decades for the New York Stock Exchange to get around to this public relations offensive, didn't it?
Right. Well, they start the public relations offensive in the teens simply to say, we have a productive role that we play in the economy, and you shouldn't regulate us because, you know, actually we're experts, and we have this private system of governance, and it's working perfectly well, and, you know, we can't have ignorant regulators, you know, state-based regulators coming in here and mucking up the works, right? So they do have that public relations message in the 19-teens where they're trying to reshape people's...
Sounds very familiar to
yeah.
someone today, right?
Yeah. So they're doing that, but what they're not doing in the teens is promoting stock ownership, because they actually feel, the governors of the New York Stock Exchange, that the more average Americans invest in the stock market, the more demands for regulation will mount, actually. That there'll be, you know, increased demand for reforms in corporate reporting and corporate governance to protect and promote the small investor, which, as I was saying before, I mean, they had a reason to suspect that, because that's kind of the whole idea in the first place, with the progressive reformers who thought that mass investment would reform large industrial corporations. They did want to see enhanced regulatory oversight of, you know, financial reporting and stock issuance and all this kind of thing. So the stock exchange, although they're talking to the public a lot more and trying to enhance their image, polish their image, they're actually discouraging their members from doing a retail business because they just sort of think it's too politically dangerous. What changes is, a couple of things. First of all, World War I convinces many of the brokerages who are members in the New York Stock Exchange that the kind of middle class, American middle class and even working class, you know, that they're good customers. They could be a big market, and we should go after them. This actually still doesn't change the minds of the governors of the New York Stock Exchange. They still perceive this as being risky business, risky politically, and also risky economically, because it required these brokerages to lend a lot of money to average Americans, middle or working class Americans, to buy securities. And so,
which they could buy on margin, partly with
borrowed
money.
Yeah, buying on margin, right? So that, to the governors of the New York Stock Exchange, you know, you let all that borrowed money in there, it's going to increase sort of volatility. People are going to lose their shirts. And stock exchange firms themselves, they're going to have to borrow a lot of money to lend a lot of money to the customers. And the governors of the New York Stock Exchange sort of perceive this as all just too risky. And they have good reason to believe so, because some of the brokerages of the New York Stock Exchange who are doing this during the war and immediately after the war do go bankrupt. So, you know, even in 1920, 1921, what have you, the stock exchange governors are still discouraging their members from serving a broader public. The real thing that tips the scales is there's a big public relations crisis at the New York Stock Exchange, which I won't go into detail right now, but it's another point where they sort of have to say, okay, what are we going to do? We're going to get regulation in here. We're going to get state-based regulation in here, and we're going to have to support our members who want to do retail brokerage, because they're so frustrated with our current policy of censoring advertisement and discouraging the retail market, that we kind of can't keep this association together, and we can't keep everybody on the same political message and on the same political wavelength within our exchange if we don't sort of get behind this desire by the retail brokerages to expand their customer base. So finally, you know, in like 1922, 1923, the stock exchange starts producing publicity, which actually encourages Americans to sort sort of own your own share in America by buying a corporate stock.
And by then, the great bull market of the 20s was underway.
And then by that point, yeah, things
And they're probably not unrelated phenomena.
Yeah, I would not. Yeah, they're definitely not unrelated. Because the other thing, actually, that the publicity campaign of the 20s at the stock exchange is conducting, its other purpose is actually to encourage people to lend money to stock market brokers so that they can then, in turn, lend money to investors. So what you get there is that's how leverage is what gets you asset bubbles, right? I mean, it's not just people wanting to buy stock. It's people borrowing a lot of money to then go buy it that drives up the prices, just like in the housing market or kind of any classic bubble that you might look at in history. Leverage is always going to play a role. So the stock exchange is not just promoting investment. They're also promoting the use of leverage.
But there's an ideological, political motive to this as well, creating this notion of a shareholder's democracy, right?
Yes, yes. And in the stock exchange's, point of view, they feel like, you know, we've been saying before the war, we were saying that our function as a stock exchange is to deliver the people's money to the people's corporations. And if people are going to believe that, then we're actually going to have to show them that millions of Americans invest in the stock market, that that's going to be a more powerful argument. And then if we can show that, what we can say to would-be regulators, what we can say in testimonies in front of legislators, what we can say in newspapers is that, you know, hey, look, the American investing public comes to us and they're voting with their pocketbooks. They're voting in favor of a privately administered exchange in contrast to public securities market regulation. So it becomes, growing the American investor class becomes part of a political strategy to avoid regulation. And the exchange is not the only institution that is in this game at this point in time in the 1920s. Corporations and other financial firms like banks that are not part of the New York Stock Exchange, you know, are also finding that increasing the number of shareholders is good public relations for them as they're trying to deal with their own.
AT&T was crucial for this.
AT&T is a prime example. And AT&T sort of struggled.
What was their material interest in this?
Right. So they have their own public relations problems coming out of the war. There's a lot of strikes amongst the AT&T workforce. There's kind of increased demands for nationalization of the telecom infrastructure. And, you know, the United States is one of the few countries in which telecommunications remains, you know, exclusively a private enterprise. There's actually a Treasury Secretary named David S. Houston, who had been a leader in the Treasury, or a leader of the World War I campaign to promote widespread bond ownership, war bond ownership. And he comes to AT&T, and, you know, he and his colleagues feel that if AT&T expands its shareholder base, you know, this is good for America. This is creating, a citizenry that has a stake in private enterprise. And it'll also, analogous to what the New York Stock Exchange is saying, you know, it'll also show the polity, it'll show the citizenry that we are, in fact, democratically owned here at AT&T and that we don't need to nationalize, telecommunications in the United States because we, in fact, have people's ownership. But in this form that's, you know, more free, more consistent with American political values. AT&T is also a classic example in the sense that, you know, AT&T, the money that they get from investors in the 1920s as they're pursuing this promotion campaign, you know, they don't put that money back into, you know, they don't build new infrastructure, you know, with that money necessarily. I mean, a lot of it goes to basically like stock buybacks and things of that sort. So, you know, it's another classic example of the stock market investors are not actually, you know, investing directly in the corporation, making new improvements in the business in terms of infrastructure, but rather their purchases are just going to from one investor to the other and increasing share price. And they also have an interest in, I should say, AT&T has a customer ownership plan and then an employee ownership plan, which is supposed to sort of, quell labor strife and, you know, prevent unionization and all that kind of stuff.
And not to be too cynical about it, but management would also have an interest in promoting very widespread stock ownership, because if you have millions of stockholders, small stockholders who don't talk to each other, management can do pretty much as it pleases.
Yeah, yeah. And a prime example of this, this is in effect what happens. I mean, the degree to which corporate executive managers are saying, you know, let's do this, is something that needs to be proven in the historical record and not just assumed. And so the one example that I was able to find in the historical record was actually General Motors, where General Motors promotes broad-based share ownership, and then actually starts a subsidiary company called the Manager Security Corporation. And GM lends money to MSC, the Manager Security Corporation, and MSC then goes and buys GM shares on behalf of sort of the corporate executives of GM. So on one hand, they're promoting stock ownership, and then on the other hand, they are concentrating a voting block of shares in the hands of their own management, right? So they're kind of going at that problem from two ways. First, we'll disperse the shareholder body across the nation. They won't be in communication with each other. They won't vie with management for control. But then, you know, we'll actually strengthen the hand of management by also making them, turning them into a holder of large block of stock, which will make them an even more powerful force in corporate governance and corporate board meetings and things like that. Oh. And this is, I should also say, you know, this is recognized by critics at the time. And I have a chapter in the book on a man named William Ripley, who's not well remembered today, but he was very well known at the time because he made this.
And he was Burley's teacher, too.
Yes, right? He was Burley's teacher and Means as well, and very influential. A lot of what he wrote was very influential in the modern corporation and private property. His writing was very influential in that book. And he makes this exact critique that, you know, this is actually not democracy at all, because these, you know, when you have hundreds of thousands of shareholders who are not in communication with each other, you know, they're completely disenfranchised in effect, and this is not some sort of people's democracy. But what's interesting is that Ripley never says we shouldn't do this. Ripley says we should do this. You know, we should get as many Americans as possible to own corporate shares, but we need to have reform of corporate governance and corporate reporting so that shareholders can be more influential in corporate governance. So in many ways, although he's critiquing this movement, he's also validating it. He's simply saying, you know, this is a good thing, but we need to put some teeth into it.
What did the Great Crash then do in the years of depression, when Wall Street was in great disrepute, that it didn't get out of disrepute for another 20 years? So what did this do to the shareholder democracy movement?
Well, the thing that I found was interesting is that, you know, despite the Great Crash of 1929 and the Great Depression, levels of share ownership remains at like 10% of American households, which is, you know, kind of from 0.5% of U.S. households in 1900 to 10%, and then it'll take off again in after World War II. So there is something kind of enduring about it. I mean, in terms of the incidence of shareholding, you know, a lot of people do lose their shirt and leave the markets, but you know, the incidence of shareholding is much greater and remains much greater than it had ever been in the first three decades of the 20th century. And it's characteristic of American capitalism, you know, even today, the extent of share ownership and the dispersed nature of ownership in the average U.S. corporation. So that, I think, in compared to other countries, has been an enduring trait despite the crash and the Great Depression. One would think that the ideological project and the ideal of a shareholder democracy would have left, you know, it's completely been discredited by the crash and the Great Depression. But you'd be very surprised that the New York Stock Exchange, you know, even after their president goes to jail for embezzlement, you know, they continue to, you know, beat the drum and say, you know, repeat these kind of same types of speeches, you know, all throughout the rest of the 20th century. So the ideal doesn't go away. I mean, I think it becomes, you know, a minority voice, certainly after the crash and the Great Depression and all through the mid-century when Keynesian economics is in ascent. But I think it remains an enduring axiom of conservative economic thought.
And then in bull market decades like the 60s and the 80s and 90s, it just takes off. Right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, and then obviously you have, you know, presidents since Reagan who want to build public policy, you know, all around the concept of the ownership society and have, you know, mass investment be, you know, linchpin of American political culture.
And of course, George Bush, George W. made that one of the now forgotten cornerstones of his administration, the ownership society. But let's just in closing, I mean, look at the present. You know, we had this tremendous financial accident for which Wall Street bears very large responsibility, yet Wall Street doesn't remain, is not in the political doghouse that you might think it is. Does the shareholder democracy thing have, has it saved Wall Street's bacon?
Well, I think that there are some enduring beliefs that originated in the period that I study that have become so foundational, such foundational assumptions that we you know, they're almost intractable. And one of these is the notion of the efficient financial markets. And I think that recent reforms, you know, continue to sort of take it for granted that lightly regulated securities markets, you know, will distribute resources, economic risk efficiently and optimally. I don't know that the recent financial crises have really discredited that in American political culture.
We also have a large portion of the American middle class's retirement security depends on the health of the financial markets, right?
So right.
Spreading the wealth around in that sense really did promote the class interest of Wall Street.
Right.
That's a remarkable, trick. Every time I read a history book, I'm reminded that the things that seem so naturalized as part of our environment have go way back. They're not.
Actors behind. They had a history, and there are actors behind them, and people made choices at some prior moment that we've forgotten. And I think our job as historians is try to bring that back out and recall that to people's memory. Because, you know, if you can see that choices were made in the past, then you can think more broadly and more freely about the choices that you have in front of you in the present day.
No wonder Henry Ford thought history was bunk. Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
That was Julia Ott, a professor of history at the New School in New York, and author of When Wall Street Met Main Street, The Quest for an Investor's Democracy, just out from Harvard University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with one more from Zex, that's spelled X-E-X. This one an homage to the Red Brigade's Rome on $5 a Day. Till next week, bye.
Boys down to quite class struggles, not academic. They want to drown every corrupt clown and lackey of the ruling class. Your kiss of death could be a Learjet. Radicals don't like the rich. It's too bourgeois to drive a big car, so it better be bulletproof. Cut off the road, bloody episode. Oh, why did you have to get in their way? You'll get to see red emergency. If the boys blow out your kneecap, it's not a game when you become lame and they booby trap your wheelchair. Please act discreet if you ever meet. Don't try to create a big scene.